performance as I did to the performers on stage. What I saw was simple and clear. They were miserable and confused after Act One, but standing and cheering at the end of Act Two. Act Two was working. Act One was not. One night I went outside and crossed the street to the restaurant where some of the audience goes during intermission. I overheard one waiter tell a couple, "Don't worry, the second act is much better." When the waiters in town know the problem and you don't do something about it, that's denial. It wasn't possible to make major changes before the opening night in Chicago, and the resulting reviews were not kind, to say the least. The critics praised the dancers, and they loved Act Two. But they thought Act One was confusing. They used words that had never been attached to my work before, words like mess and risible. The show was in trouble. My old friend Jennifer Tipton had flown in from New York for the opening. We had breakfast the next morning with the reviews in front of us. A Broadway veteran of 30 years, she didn't try to console me. She said, "You know they're right." I nodded my head. "Yes, I know." This was, as the clichés have it, the first step toward a solution. Denial was no longer an option. The next day, a Monday, I had to face a cast and crew that was bruised, tired, and worried. To compound the trauma, a New York newspaper had decided to reprint one of the scathing reviews, breaking the long tradition of letting Broadway-bound shows work out their kinks out of town in private. Publishing out-of-town reviews before a single New York performance was simply not done. This set off a public debate between the theater world and the press. Moving out had become news for all the wrong reasons. People, it seemed, were gunning for us. Changes had to be made, and I would have 3 weeks in Chicago and only 3 rehearsal days in New York to make them before the first previews prior to our Broadway opening. I was not a novice at the art of change. I knew the repertoire of tweak and cut and add and replace and reposition. I had been doing this for years. What made this especially challenging is that there were so many different areas to look at. Was the problem in the music? I cut one song, thought about putting in 3 or 4 others, wound up adding one. Was the problem in the narrative? I simplified the story and pushed one character forward so that more of the show revolved around him. To do that, I had to shrink another character who had functioned almost as a narrator in one incarnation, like the stage manager in Our Town. Was the problem scenic or visual? We'd had some wig problems early on that made it hard for the audience to recognize the characters from one scene to the next. But the wardrobe and scenery now seemed pretty much okay. I'd replay the entire show in my head at night and wonder, is the wrong song playing here? Is the wrong character in this scene? Are they coming in the wrong door? Are they doing the wrong steps? Everywhere I looked, I thought, hey, let's fix that. The wonderful and scary thing about solving creative problems is that there isn't one right answer. There are 1,000 possible answers, but the valuable and practical thing to do is fix the things you know how to fix. That's why a failure of skill is unforgivable. If you don't have a broad base of skills, you're limiting the number of problems you can solve when trouble hits. Fortunately, I had more than just the skill to choreograph. Most of the decisions that had to be made now were directing and editing choices, and I could do that too. During the sleepless nights in Chicago, when I reran the show from memory, I looked for the changes that would bring Act One into tighter focus and let Act Two run as gloriously as it had from the start. I was tempted to believe that the scenes worked fine in their current order just because I had seen them that way for so long now. See repetition previously. But I needed to resist that temptation. It was time to clean the slate and look at everything fresh. My support came from my routine, my sustenance from my rituals of self-reliance. I made it a point of honor to be at the gym 2 blocks away from my hotel room each morning at 7 a.m. for a 2-hour workout. I needed the routine not just for endurance. It was also important for me to believe that I was still in shape, that my body functioned. If everything fell apart and I was wiped out, I could always go back to dancing. At night after each show, with my mind still racing, I would follow the same comforting heat ritual, pouring myself into a hot bath and letting my brain go blank. The producers, to their credit, were supportive. While I was making changes on stage, they could have made the ultimate change, fire me and bring in another director to save the show. But they didn't. They rallied around us. We were all in this together, paddling a leaky canoe in a choppy stream heading toward New York City. Our mantra was, stay in the canoe. When I was making all these changes, in effect, I was scratching again, trying to claw out an idea that would clarify the show for the audience. To some degree, the scratching and changes worked. The show was getting better. It wasn't frozen yet, but at least it was jello. I also listened to people I trusted. One friend told me she had sat next to a woman at a performance who put her hands over her eyes for one song and then over her ears for another. My friend asked the woman at intermission, "What's going on? Don't you like it?" "Oh, no," said the woman. "I like it. I just don't know where to get my information." This was echoed by another friend, a major director, who told me, "You're doing too much, trying too hard. Make each scene about one thing, not three things." Making the changes was a brutal process. When you cut and replace words on your computer, the words don't have feelings. They can't talk back to you. It's the same when you work with film.